The following is a presentation of Grace Covenant Baptist Church, West Monroe, Louisiana.
Okay, come on in. We are continuing in the fourth chapter of Timothy. We're about to wind down 2 Timothy. Probably this week and maybe next week, and we'll wind that up, and then we're going to do Titus. And then beyond that, I don't know what we're going to do. So, but anyway, we're still in 2 Timothy chapter 4. And we're going to look primarily this week at verses 3 through 8. And we're going to go back and review a little bit. Remember that the charge for this chapter is to preach the gospel. And we saw that this this is some of the last words that Paul ever wrote before his execution. He begins this chapter, and let's go back and review just a little bit. If we go back to verse 1, he begins with a charge. And we see that he says, "I charge you, I, Paul, charge you, Timothy." So the initial recipient is Timothy. But we also saw that by extension, it probably applies to any man that preaches, teaches, or to anyone who witnesses. So by extension, it applies to all regenerate believers. And we see at the beginning in verse 1 that there are three aspects of this charge. And we don't see this in verse 1. We see this throughout the chapter. There are four aspects of this charge that we need to examine. The first is the nature of the charge, that is, what Timothy's to do. It's the basis or the argument upon which he bases this charge, and then he gives a personal example in the latter parts of the chapter. So again, verse 1, he charges Timothy and us, and he charges in three directions. He says, first, look at Christ, the coming judge and king. That's in verse 1. The second is the contemporary scene, which begins in verse 3, and that's what we're going to begin to look at today. And then third is to look at Paul himself as an example, which we'll see in verse 6. So the essence of the charge that he gives Timothy, which we see in verse 2, is preach the word. That's the bottom line emphasis for the charge. The word we saw consists of Old Testament scriptures that Timothy was well familiar with because he'd been taught that from his childhood, and it also includes Paul's teaching, which Timothy had followed and learned and firmly believed. So Timothy is to preach the word. He's to speak the word that God has spoken. And his responsibilities are not just to hear it, not to just believe it, not to just obey what he hears, not to guard it from distortion or falsification, not to suffer for it, but he is now to preach it. He is to physically speak it to others. And we saw that this good news, this word is the gospel, it's the good news of salvation, and he's to be almost as a herald in a marketplace to proclaim it. We saw that Paul gave four characteristics of this message that he's to proclaim. It's to be urgent, it's to be relevant, it's to be patient, and it's to be intelligent. So as we said earlier, he instructs Timothy to look in three directions. He's to first look at the coming Christ. He's to secondly look at the contemporary scene, and then to look at Paul's example. And then we saw last week where we talked about Paul's discussion of Christ's coming in judgment, which now brings us to the second direction, that is the contemporary scene in which Timothy finds himself. And we will begin that in verse 3. So let me do something I don't often do. I want to read these passages, and then we'll come back to them. So beginning of verse 3 in ESV. Says, "For the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander into myths. And I'm going to start with that and we'll come back and continue. Notice at the beginning of verse 3, we find the word for, or because. So he has linked what he said previously to verse 3. And this is where we find his second basis, where he grounds this charge that he's making. Now, he had talked about Christ's coming, which is obviously future, and he's kind of, in a sense, talking about another future event here. The sense is that before the end comes, there will be dark and difficult days. And he seems to be anticipating that this situation is going to deteriorate. But also we know from this chapter and from his earlier writings that this difficult time has already begun for Timothy. But in light of this contemporary scene, he then gives a series of further directions. So if we're doing our 5 W's and an H, if we're investigating the text, we might ask, you know, what are these times like? Now, he's already talked about that in terms of the false teachers. But here he's going to begin to give us some further direction. So it seems here that the one primary characteristic that he highlights is that people will not tolerate the truth. He expresses it, he says, is not enduring sound teaching, but accumulating teachers that suit their own liking. Verse 3, so they'll turn away from listening to the truth and wander into myths, verse 4. So we might say it in another way, that they can't stand the truth, but they refuse to listen to it. Instead, they find teachers that suit their own speculative fantasies into which they are determined to wander. Now, all of this has to do with their ears. Not physical ears, although there's some indication of that. But the term ears is mentioned twice in the original language. And the sense of it is that they suffer from a particular pathological condition called itching ears. That is, they have an itch, they have a yin, they have a desire for novelty. And we saw that before in terms of the women that were being led astray. Now, we know that if you have dogs, you know sometimes they get ear mites and their ears itch physically. Sometimes if you get some kinds of disorder, your ears physically itch. But he's not talking about a physical thing here. He's using a figure of speech for the kind of curiosity which looks for interesting and spicy bits of information. And this itching, this desire, this yin, is relieved by the messages of the new teachers. So, in fact, the people stop up their ears against the truth and open them up to any teacher who will relieve this tickling by scratching it. Let's go for a minute. Let's take a little side trip. Let's go to Acts. Go to Acts 7. Actually, Acts 6. We want to start in Acts 6. This is the story of Stephen. When Stephen's preaching to the masses, so to speak, to the public, and they became pretty agitated with him. So Acts 6, verse 10. Said, but they could not withstand the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. Stephen was speaking. Now, let's go over to chapter 7, verse 57. This is the same group and this is the same situation we're perceiving as teaching, preaching. Verse 57 says, "But they cried out with a loud voice and stopped their ears, and rushing together at him, et cetera, et cetera." So what they've done here in Ephesus, what they've done is they've stopped up their ears. They've stopped listening to the truth and opened them up to these false teachers. And my pages are stuck together. There we go. That we saw in verse 3, and the truth that we saw in verse 4, and what they prefer is their own liking, again, verse 3, and myths in verse 4. So they substitute their own fancy, if you please, for God's revelation. And in addition to that, the criterion that they use by which they judge these teachers, and it's not by Scripture as it should be, but it's by their own subjective tastes. Now that is fraught with difficulty. If you're going to judge the truth of something by my own subjective opinion, what happens when my opinion is different from Barry's? What happens when his is different from Rudy's? You have no foundational base to establish, quote, truth. So in addition to that, even worse, they didn't listen to what was being taught. They didn't listen to what they've heard, and to decide whether it was true, judge it against Scripture. They decided what was true and then found teachers who would support that. So it's a complete reversal. It's a complete flip of how they should approach truth. So again, if we're questioning this text, then we would, in light of that, we would begin to ask, you know, how did Timothy react to this, given what we know about his disposition? And we might suspect that in such a desperate situation, it would silence him. If men can't bear the truth, if they won't listen, then surely the prudent course is to be quiet. But we see from this text that Paul draws a completely different conclusion. For the third time in this book, he says to Timothy, "But as for you," so he's calling Timothy to be different, and Timothy must not take his lead from the prevailing fashions of the day. And then there follows four brief, clipped almost, if you please, commands, which seem to be deliberately framed in relation to this situation and to the situation in which Timothy finds himself and the kind of people that he's ministering to. So beginning verse 5, this is where we see the third, as for you, or but as for you in some translations. But as for you, and here's the four things: always be sober-minded, endure suffering, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. So he says, first of all, be sober-minded. Now, we've seen that concept before in chapter 1 when he was talking about elders and deacons. It's that same concept of sober-mindedness. But here he seems to be saying that because the people are unstable, they're unstable in mind, they're unstable in conduct, that you, Timothy, above everything else, you're to be steady. And it's a literal translation to be sober, but figuratively to be free from any form of mental or spiritual drunkenness, to be well-balanced, to be self-controlled. And then the concept that rests on when folks get intoxicated with heady heresies or sparkling novelties, ministers, teachers, witnesses must remain calm and sane, which sometimes is difficult, particularly being calm. I don't question any of our sanity, but sometimes it's really hard to be calm. Yeah, as has been going on this week for those of y'all who Twitter. You know, I don't, but I've had folks tell me some of the stuff that's going on. So, okay. Secondly, he says, be sober-minded. Secondly, he says to endure suffering. So, although these folks are not gonna, they're not gonna listen to sound teaching, Timothy is to persist in teaching it. And by doing so, be prepared to suffer on account of the truth that he refuses to compromise. Whenever biblical faith becomes unpopular, ministers, teachers, witnesses are tempted to mute those elements which give the most offense. And there's a lot of contemporarily of that kind of stuff going on. He says, be sober-minded, endure suffering, do the work of an evangelist. Now, because these folks are truly ignorant of the evangelistic message, Timothy is to do the work of an evangelist. Now, this may refer to a specialized ministry that's referred to in other places in the New Testament. But it more likely seems to be that it's anyone who preaches, teaches, witnesses the gospel and witnesses to Christ, to be that, to deliver that kind of evangelistic message. So in either case, what Paul is saying is for Timothy to make the preaching of the good news, the preaching of the gospel, to make that his life's work. And then fourthly, he says, fulfill your ministry. Now, even though folks are going to forsake Timothy's ministry in favor of these false teachers, Timothy is to persevere. He is to fulfill his ministry. He's to persevere until his task is accomplished. So, although the details of these four commands differ, The general message seems to be the same, that these difficult days in which it's hard to gain a hearing for the gospel are not to discourage you. They're not to defer you from your ministry. They're not to induce you to trim your ministry or your message to suit the hearers. It's not to silence you altogether. Instead, it's to influence, to spur you on to preach even more. And we would have the same challenge, we would have the same exhortation to us. The harder the times and the deafer the people, and I didn't know deafer was a word, but I guess it is, the more deaf people are, the clearer and more persuasive our proclamation must be. Yeah, that's an applicational point. And that's the general application. I mean, he's talking specifically to Timothy, but by extension, it's any minister, teacher, preacher, witness. So it's all of us. Okay, here's your Calvin quote for the week. Calvin wrote, "The more determined men become to despise the teaching of Christ, the more zealous should godly ministers be to assert it, and the more strenuous their efforts to preserve it entire, and more than that, by their diligence to ward off Satan's attacks." So it's kind of a double implication. It's the positive to preach salvation, but the negative is to ward off Satan's attacks, and he's going to attack it. And we see that in a lot of different ways. So.
That's interesting. A lot of times, as we read this text, you know, because Paul tells Timothy to preach the word, we tend to kind of, buttonhole this whole discussion into just simply the preaching or, you know, evangelistic type endeavors, those kinds of things. But evangelist, the euangelion, that's just the good news. And so it goes further than just simple preaching. It's the application, what we were talking about a second ago, the application of the good news in every facet of life. And so, you know, it's the good news in how we raise our children. It's the good news in how we conduct business. It's the good news in how we interact with, you know, the people around us. You know, how we deal with a neighbor whose dog keeps digging up my flowers. You know, it's the good news in everything. And so that really does broaden it from just the pastor or the leadership of the church to the entire church, that we're to be messengers, harbingers of the good news in so many areas of life. And the sad thing about it is that as we do that, as we share with others the good news, the gospel, as it relates to, you know, our marriages, it's rejected because it requires that lot of wives miss their husbands and husbands love their wives. The two areas that both husbands and wives have trouble with. It requires that children be raised in the admonitions of the Lord, which is something that kids don't like to do. And so as modern kind of pop culture continues to invade our thinking, more and more people will be upset by truly the good news given to them in every facet of life. And so not only do they want to run after Oprah, who tells them that everything's okay, they get mad at those who say, no, everything's not okay. If you continue in this direction in your marriage or in raising of your kids or in your business, you're going to have problems, real problems in the not-too-distant future, and people will begin to reject what the church says about the good news applied in daily life for those other alternate voices that just tend to scratch their itching ears.
Yeah, and the sense here is it's a direct verbal presentation, which some of us are reticent to do. There's also on the other side of that, I'm diverting here, getting off track here a little bit. The other side of that is there's a behavioral example of that. When your grandson digs up your flowers, how do you react to that? You know, when you get your four-wheeler stuck in the mud, how do you react to that? So there's an observable. Yeah, when both of your laptops crash on the same day, what do you, you know? So there's an observable behavioral piece to it, but the sense here is that it's an actual verbal presentation in all of these situations. Okay, then we come to the third, the third basis for his charge, namely his own impending execution and martyrdom. I never can say that word right. Judy corrects me all the time. Martyrdom. So in verse 5, he's given Timothy this list of things he is to do or not to do. And then in verse 6, we begin to see this personal example. And we see the link between the paragraph starting in verse 6 and what has preceded in verse 5. His argument would go something like, But as for you, Timothy, you must fulfill your ministry because I am already at the point of death. And it's all the more important, it's all the more vital for Timothy to continue and complete his ministry because Paul's life work has reached completion and is about to close. And we see here that he uses two figures of speech regarding his death. One comes from the language of sacrifice, and the other one, interestingly enough, is from boats or ships. I'll come back to that in just a minute. First, he says he's already at the point of being sacrificed. He likens his life to a libation or to a drink offering that's been poured out. And so imminent, he believes that his execution is so imminent that he speaks of it as if it had already begun. He says, "For I am already being poured out as a libation or as a drink offering." And then he goes on to say his departure has come. Now, departure in this sense had kind of commonly begun to be used as death, but it can also mean a loosening. And it's been used for either striking a tent or release from shackles or from untying a boat from its moorings. So the two images he used here, to some extent correspond to the end of his life. The end being poured out as a libation. I see some looks of consternation. I'll get it. I mean, stay with me. I'm going to get there. Being poured out as a libation as the end of his life and the beginning of another, as if putting out to sea. That already the anchors have been weighed, already the ropes have been released, and the boat is about to set sail for another shore or another realm. But before that adventure, that voyage begins, he's looking back over his 30-year ministry, and then he describes it factually, not boastfully, which we see in this next section. It says, "For I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come." Verse 7, "I've fought the good fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith." So he's anticipating, figuratively, his ship sailing, but then he also looks back over his ministry and begins to describe what has already happened. He says, "I fought the good fight." This could be rendered, "I have run the great race," and it seems to denote any contest that involves exertion. It could be a race, it could be a fight. But because of the next phrase, he seems to be alluding to a race or a course that he's finished. Seems that he's combining again the soldier-athlete metaphors. We've seen that previously. He seems to combine them again here, or at least he's using the wrestling or the running metaphors. Secondly, he says, "I've finished the race." Again, it's that running metaphor. Some years before this, he was speaking to the Ephesian elders. And that's the church over which Timothy now presides. And he expressed his ambition to do exactly this. He says in Acts 20:24, "I do not account my life of any value, nor is precious to myself, if only I may accomplish my course and the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus." So as he looks back, as he reflects on his 30-year ministry, he is now able to say, "I have done exactly that." Thirdly, he says, "I've kept the faith." This could mean that he's kept faith with Christ, which he obviously did, but contextually, it seems more likely that he's affirming his faithfulness to the importance of guarding the deposit or guarding revealed truth. He seems to say, I've safely persevered as a guardian or steward of the gospel treasure committed to my trust. So we have a verbal picture of this apostle. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed skip one. Finish the race, I've kept faith. Okay. So we see that Paul, in some extent, all believers, is pictured as a fight, as a race to guard the treasure. It involves labor, sacrifice, and sometimes even danger. And all three of these, Paul had been faithful to the end. So nothing now remains except for him to collect his reward. He said, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. So, nothing now remains but the prize, which he's termed as a crown or a garland of righteousness that's laid up for him when he finishes on that day. And he says that the same vindication by Christ also awaits those who love his appearing, the regenerate believers. Now, we have to be careful here because some would say that this is the doctrine of justification by works. I thought I turned my phone off. And we know obviously that Paul did not preach that. This is not the doctrine of works. He emphasized his conviction that salvation is a free gift of God's grace, and it's not by virtue of any of our goodness or any of our works. So the crown of righteousness, he is anticipating the crown of righteousness is awarded to all those who set their hearts on Christ's coming appearance and not because of any of their meritorious action. The unbeliever, being unjustified, dreads the coming of Christ if he believes it or even thinks about it. Thus, being unready for it, he will shrink in shame from Christ at his coming. The believer, on the other hand, having been justified, looks toward Christ's coming and sets his heart on it. Being ready for it, we will have boldness when Christ appears. And it's only those who have entered by faith into the benefit of Christ's first coming that eagerly await his second coming. So in this passage, we've got the verbal picture of an aging Paul. He had described himself like this previously a couple of years before in his letter to Philemon. He's fought the good fight. He's finished the race. He's kept the faith. His lifeblood is on the point of being poured out. His little boat is about to sail. He's eagerly awaiting his crown. And it's these facts that are intended to encourage or to spur Timothy and subsequently by extension us on to even greater proclamation and greater faithfulness. So kind of in summary, our God is a God of history. He's working out his purposes as each year succeeds the other, which is kind of appropriate for a new year. He buries his workmen, but the work continues. The gospel is handed down from one generation to the next. As the leaders of the former generation die, it's all the more urgent for those of the next generation to step forward and take their place. So we might suspect that Timothy was profoundly moved by this exhortation from Paul, who was this old warrior who had led Timothy to Christ. But in like manner, we cannot rest on the leadership of the preceding generation. The day comes when we must step into their shoes and ourselves take the lead. That time had come for Timothy. And that time will come for all of us at some point in time. So in view of the coming Christ to judge, the contemporary world's distaste for the gospel, the imprisoned apostle's imminent death, this letter charges Timothy, and it charges us with a sense of solemn urgency. Preach, Lord. That's the overarching principle from this entire section. Preach the word. And that's our challenge. We will, God willing, next week we'll begin to unpack the final portion of this chapter and of this book. And we'll begin to look at verses 9 through 22 as we wrap this book up. I think it's been a good study. As I said to y'all in the beginning, 2 Timothy is the book that's used for the initial precept training. So it's kind of been one of my favorite books all along. A lot of truth here. Okay, thoughts, questions, comments? I'm giving you back 2 minutes. That's unusual.